listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist and writer on health, food, and the environment for over a couple of decades, and I report in a host of venues, including EcoWatch, The Huffington Post, Alternet, and my own website, healthjournalistblog.com. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your health and well-being and the total environment in which we all live, our health context. So we talk about the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our families, the health of our society, and the health of the earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, I bring you different thought leaders, authors, experts, advocates, doctors, healers, policymakers, all of whom are addressing different aspects of how we can create health and well-being and address the things in our world that undermine health and life. This week's show, I'm really excited to bring back a guest that we've had before. So thrilled to have Susan Griffin with us today yet again. It's been a couple of years. We last had her on the program in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear incident. We'll be talking today with Susan, who's really extraordinary, about the connection between a lot of inner and social aspects of our being and our connection to the earth. Susan is an outstanding writer. She's really first class. She's been writing and teaching for over 40 years. Although she's best known for her creative nonfiction, she's written in every genre. Her essays and poems have been anthologized. Among her 20 books is A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, a New York Times notable book, and a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Award. It ultimately won the North California Book Award. The Book of Courtesans, a catalog of their virtues, was another of her bestsellers, as well as her groundbreaking work, Woman and Nature, which connects the denigration of women with the devaluation of nature. And that book inspired the movement known as ecofeminism, which we're going to be talking about a great deal on this program. She's been named by Utney Reader as one of the 100 most important visionaries for our time, and she's received many grants, including an NEA grant, a MacArthur grant, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and much, much more. She's working, I know, on several wonderful books right now. She's written online for The Huffington Post, the Women's Media Center, and Open Democracy. So we're going to be talking today about a broad range of topics. As a writer and journalist myself, I deeply admire Susan, and we're just so happy to have you with us today again, Susan, on Connect the Dots. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This has been a kind of a tough year for women. And I would say that in prior years, I really never spoke very much or had too many programs that were more directly from a women's rights or women's needs or feminist perspective. But as there's been more and more negative pushback in our world, I'm doing that more and more on this program. The other day on my Facebook page, somebody got into a dialogue with a man whom ultimately I unfriended for his many misogynist comments. But the young person whom I kind of left to wrestle with him rather than intervening because I felt, well, you know, let her build her muscles on this one and her chops on how to talk to people with, you know, kind of attitudes, expressed attitudes that were quite hostile toward women. You know, I said to her, how was that? And she said, it was okay for me because I want people to see that what we are expressing in terms of what's going on in our world and in being directed toward women is not imaginary. It's real. I was I was touched that she felt the need to step up and do that. What's your feeling about where, since the time when you have been talking about these connections and kind of raising consciousness about them, where are we now in what we are struggling with? One of your books also is called Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy. What are we wrestling with now?
Well, you know, I think we still have in place the basic psychological and philosophical structure that creates both sexism and racism, and of course, it's a structure that creates class difference and class prejudice. But you know, when I say philosophy, most people go, oh, ho-hum, you know, that's something that goes on in the classroom and it's not relevant to us. But I'm thinking of philosophy as something that is a set of assumptions that underlie everything we do, and it's very, very powerful precisely because it's not spoken. And so people behave according to this way of seeing the world without knowing that they're seeing the world in a very particular way. They're not seeing the truth. They're looking at it through a distorting lens, in the case of this philosophy particularly. And that distorting lens is wrapped up with the whole history of colonialism and the oppression of women, and, of course, through colonialism, racism. And that is the idea that, for one thing, the sort of foundation of this philosophy, this way of looking at the world, is the idea that the material world and the spiritual world are separate. And independent of each other, so that the material world is really a degraded realm, and that's been part of the theology of many religions in their more what we call, and it's part of this ideology to call them that, developed religions, and I would say more corrupted. I would say instead of developed, more corrupted religions, because in their earlier state, such as Christianity, in its early state, and with many of the Christian teachers along the way who didn't go along with the program, spirit was looked at as part of the earth. I mean, that's just what, when Jesus said the kingdom is at hand, that's what he was talking about, you know. So, but already their empire was in place, and not only from the Romans, but also early Hebrew attitudes of empire, so that women were not on an equal plane with men. There's been a lot of work done with Mary Magdalene now that, you know, Mary Magdalene really was a prophet too, and a kind of colleague, a kind of partner with Jesus, if not his lover. So, but I mean also a working partner. You know, it may seem like this is some kind of obscure, again, philosophical point that doesn't relate to us, but it really does. For instance, let's take the idea that well, we don't have to worry about global warming because we're building these space stations and we'll go live on space stations. So it's a sort of sense in which, you know, somehow the human spirit is not implicate in the earth. We're not part of the earth. We're separate from it. We're above it. And that's a disastrous attitude to have, especially right now when we're facing the ruination of the earth because of so many of our policies. So I'll say more about that in a minute, but I don't want to go on and on.
Well, I actually, you know, I would define myself as someone who's had a very ambivalent relationship with certain types of spiritual teachings, precisely because of what you're describing. It seemed like, you know, if that really is the highest, but to me, you know, perhaps, and it's being taught in various quarters, but it also seems like, you know, men who want to go to the Father and go up into some ultimate abstraction and kind of get away from it all, because there are too many problems here. So there are many kinds of approaches to spirituality that teach that, you know, this is all an illusion. We made it up in our mind.
Yeah.
If we saw it differently, it would appear differently. You know, there is, like, I may think I see a chair. I may sit in the chair. But because of the nature of my mind, the chair I'm sitting in isn't the same. If it's a theater and we traded seats, you wouldn't be sitting in the same chair on some level. Now, that's not to say that the chair might not be more or less comfortable for you and me, depending upon, you know, our condition of our spine, how much fat we have in our body, how we're feeling that day overall, and a whole bunch of other things. But there even comes into it a whole dispute about whether the chair is actually there. You know, of course, we know on the atomic level, nothing is there. But, I mean, if you could clarify some of that, I've been confused by it for years, personally.
Well, it doesn't. On the atomic level, because there's all this space in every tiny particle, doesn't mean that nothing is there. There is something there that's producing the material world. So it's not nothing. It's just that there's a lot of nothings inside the particle, but there's also something, you know. The sexism, you know, you have to do something with the material world. What do you do with it, you know? So there are people who sort of explain it away and say, oh, it's all in our heads, which is, to me, the ultimate narcissistic point of view. You know, only I exist in my imagination and nothing else is real.
Right.
And that, of course, is something that fits very well with, say, a philosophy that empowers the not just the 1% but the 0.001%, which represents corporate wealth and in the United States. That mentality that others literally don't count, and then you know, there's a reason that we call that sort of outlook as a Brahmin philosophy, because in India the Brahmin class was much more privileged than everybody else and looked at others as just there to serve them, and so this attitude of, you know, I exist and nobody else exists, and therefore they're not important, and I can exploit them. Of course, it's also a certain one interpretation of Plato's cave, you know, that, but you have to remember that Plato came, you know, Plato was part of the Greek, even though he was against the military and argued against military power. He was part of Greek hegemony at that time. The hegemony of Athens, Athens, and you know, this idea that what's in the cave, meaning the earth, is only just a slight representative of the real thing, and the real thing are these principles somewhere up in the sky. Well, that division between sky and the earth is also represented in gender, the way we define it. And have defined it since Plato, since before Plato, and that is, you know, women are identified with the earth and men are identified with the sky,
right.
And that by the way doesn't go all the, you know, people often say, well, that's the archetype, and that goes back all the way through human history. It does not. At one point, women and men. Both the male and the female were identified with the sky, with the sun. Both male and female were identified with the moon, and both male and female identified with the earth. So that split is not something that is inevitable at all, but it does reflect patterns of power, and it reflects empowering, for one thing, the military. The whole way that we define masculinity, if you really think about it, you know, it's one of these assumptions that we don't think about, and that's what's important about philosophy, not you know, to argue how many angels are on the head of a pin or whatever obscure linguistic feature you're discussing, but to take apart these assumptions that we don't examine, and we don't examine masculinity. We think we treat it as if it's biological. Well, to a certain degree, testosterone has effects. So women have testosterone too, by the way. But it's not all men in all cultures across the world universally behave the same. Not even all men within Western culture behave the same. And if you look at the way men are, the culture says they're supposed to be, they're supposed to be like good soldiers,
mm-hmm.
you know, tough, willing to kill, willing to be killed, not terribly emotional, mm-hmm. believing in an abstract principle that's separate from the people they love, from their own bodies, from their own survival, from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And these abstract principles are often articulated, you know, as nationalism, as patriotism. And, you know, they're sacrificed on, they're taught to be sacrificed. How else do you get, you know, a 17-year-old, a 16-year-old, 17-year-old? I mean, the recruits in the Greek armies, which is where I think this got started, well, not necessarily with the Greeks, but with in that period in the ancient world, the recruits, they had to, if you had an empire, you had to have a standing army. So you had to convince very young boys, really, not even all the way men, that this was a great thing to sacrifice their lives for the values of, you know, for their nation, whatever their nation was. And so, you know, or also to violate your basic human experience of empathy. Empathy, you don't have to have religion to have empathy, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm all for religious and spiritual training if it heightens empathy, it articulates empathy, it articulates human values. I myself am a spiritual person. I just don't belong to any organized religion. But the empathy is not something that's separate from the body, again. And it's one of the reasons I don't regard spirituality as separate from the body either, by the way. So empathy is part of the way the brain operates. And this is being discovered now by cognitive science. Scientists, you can look at the work of George Lakoff, for instance, on this question. You can't learn without empathy. If you watch little children, they'll imitate you. It's really sweet. You know, I had my grandchildren used to imitate my smile by sort of squeezing their eyes together, because that happens naturally when I smile. It doesn't with them, that they used to imitate my smile that way. I mean, you know, because that's how children learn. They imitate what the people around them are doing, whether it's an older sibling or the adults or their teachers. And that involves empathy. You feel as the other person feels. You get a feeling for the way they are, for what they're feeling, for what they're doing. And so what has to happen in military training is empathy has to be unlearned. And a lot of masculinity is related to unlearning empathy. Men are separated from the material often, and I apologize to any men who are out there who are not like this. And there's more and more young men who are not like this, and older guys who've shifted around or who never were like this. So I'm talking about this idea of how men are supposed to be. I'm not talking about how real men really are, but this shifting, the ability to mentally shift away from your material existence is helped along by the fact that in traditional societies, women do all the physical labor that is required for us to survive. So in the household, women cook the meals, they clean up, they clean the household, they change the baby's diapers, they take care of the physical needs of the household. Meaning that, and then when a man goes to work, he's got a secretary who brings him his coffee, who brews the coffee, who, you know, somebody goes out and gets him lunch, or he goes to a restaurant where somebody else is preparing lunch. And it's also true, by the way, if you look at it right on, all the people that we consider lower on the ladder socially and politically in our society, people who, there's a new term for it, instead of people of color, the term that's being used now, and I really like it, is sort of racially identified, you know, like, I can't remember the exact term, but it's people who are identified according to their race, you know, rather than according to their humanness and their unique being. So he goes to the restaurant and his dirty plates are removed by busboys who are often from another culture and another skin color, and of course you have the in this country the history of slavery, in which African people who were forced into labor and held as slaves did all the physical work, not only on the farm but also in the households. So you have this division away from the earth, and the closer you are, and then of course you have working class people who do physical work, who go to factories or do manufacturing work or wait on tables, and so you have this, you have a class, and until the feminist movement, that class used to be almost, not completely, but almost exclusively white men. Who are separated from the earth. Now we have some women who can serve in that class too. And they don't always remember who they are, or they don't always remember the oppression of other women. But some do. But it would be very hard to keep that connection in a world in which, you know, one is disconnected from the earth. And this disconnection is very serious right now. Mm-hmm. It's very serious because. We are somehow, most people, I would say the vast majority of people, believe that global warming is real. They understand that, and along with 99% of climatologists, they understand that global warming is real and it is caused by human decisions that are not very wise. But understanding that hasn't made us as a society move to do what needs to be done. This should be at the top priority of absolutely everything we do. Nothing should come before us unless we're directly under attack or, you know, somebody in our family is terribly ill. Nothing else should come before it. Mm-hmm. This should be the focus of all our efforts right now, of our government. The military ought to be used to help deal with global warming. By the way, the military is quite aware of global warming and that it will have consequences for national security. But are they doing anything to actually stop global warming? No. I mean, you know, I would stop pulling oil from the ground right now and make it a felony to do so, and imprison those who are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are endangering all our lives. If somebody came up to me and pointed a gun at my head and said, you know, you've got to turn over your wallet, this person would end up in jail, and you know, if they were caught. Now, these fellows who are pulling the oil out of the ground and wanting to do it in tar sands and creating terrible, terrible pollution, endangering all of us, not only through raising the carbon dioxide level in the air, but also through, you know, transporting oil on trains that crash and pipelines that break, and the region of the extraction itself in tar sands is being completely despoiled, and this is criminal. It's already causing terrible illness in the people who live in those regions. It's violating First Peoples lands. The original peoples of Canada, and yet, you know, not they're being honored. They make billions of dollars. They ought to be put into jail because they're threatening all of our lives, just as if they were holding a gun to our heads. So we're living in, you know, our society is really skewed at this point. And the reason that we don't see what's right in front of us is that we've been trained not to look. We've been trained not to see what is right in front of us. One of my great inspirations as a young, very young woman when I was still in college, I was introduced to the work of Hannah Arendt, and she's been a great inspiration to me. And one of her, one of the things that she talks about in I believe it's The Origins of Totalitarianism, she talks about how under Hitler, Goebbels would deny that the Allies were successful at all in bombing German cities. Of course, a lot of German cities were reduced to rubble, and they weren't functioning, and people couldn't get food. There was no transportation. There was no clean water. I mean, people were living on the edge of survival. They could see rubble all around them, and yet, when Goebbels said the Allies were not successful in bombing, they believed Goebbels rather than what they were seeing. So it's a very profound sort of. It goes along with speaking of wrestling with the angel of democracy. Not able to take in and see what's right in front of you is the result of a very profound authoritarianism. And I know that that's an extreme example. It comes from you know, one of the worst dictatorships that we've ever known. But the reason that was able to take hold is that we've had centuries of a kind of authoritarianism, where people are trained out of believing the information they take in sensually, even though we have existed on this earth, the whole time we've existed on this earth, you know, for all the millions of years we've existed, our senses, and I'm talking about since before we were recognizable as humans, we began as unicellular organisms. Our senses, the human body, and the human sensual ability evolved with the earth. So you know, the history of who we are is implicate with everything else on the earth, and we evolved to have an ability to know and see that would help us survive, and not only survive defensively, but survive cooperatively with other species, more importantly, cooperatively.
Let's just talk. So basically, what you're saying is that the reason that people see but don't see or cannot see is because there's a vision imposed upon them that they've, you know, imbibed and come to accept as part of the social conditioning that has gone on progressively over many centuries.
Yeah, thank you for saying that.
You know, so it's not just simply. You know, bad people, you're not paying attention or, you know, anything of that kind.
No.
You know, but let's talk a little bit about totalitarianism.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word, and I think, and, you know, and I must say, I think about that a great deal. You know, what I think a lot of people, you know, if you talk about it, then it's a conspiracy or something like that.
Mm.
You know, conspiracy means something, you know, specific of people planning behind the scenes beyond the range of what, you know, we see or know. Let's say that's a conspiracy if somebody's. Mm. But, of course, that goes on all the time. People are planning beyond the range. They're strategically going on. So let's strip away that word so we can talk a little bit about, you know, politically, sociologically, psychologically. What is totalitarianism? How do we feel it? How do we know it? What is it actually? What does that mean? I think a lot of people maybe don't even think much about that or, you know, are afraid to.
Well, you know, I think that... We do still have the shreds of, but we still do have some remaining democracy in this country. But we're rapidly moving towards totalitarianism. I recommend everybody to see. I mean, it's hard, very hard going, but to see this film called Citizen Four about Edward Snowden. And I have to admit, I myself didn't really fully understand the significance of what he discovered until I saw that film, and it's very, very frightening. And you can sort of see how somebody in the CIA or NSA in this case, you know, would just say, well, you know, this is the most efficient way of gathering information, and we can do it, and so let's do it. You have to, you know, in order not to have this sort of thing occur, you've got to be very aware. And I think there's been a steady erosion of, well, I shouldn't say steady erosion, because it's since the founding of our nation, there's been a wrestling. That's why I titled the book Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy, because there's been this wrestling with democracy. There have been people who don't want democracy and those who want to expand democracy. And of course, democracy doesn't exist unless it's in its expanded version. In other words, if you only have, as the nation began, wealthy or men who own property and who were white, able to vote, then you don't really have a democracy. So we've won the vote for women. We've won the vote for and we've ended slavery, and so we have the vote, but that doesn't mean that we really have a democracy. If for instance, every citizen's cell phone, every citizen's computer, every citizen's telephone calls are being monitored. And it isn't only the macro data telling people, where we're calling and who we're calling, but also the content. And a lot can be constructed about our lives so that if, I use a credit card, and we all see this every time you use a credit card, it shows up on your Facebook, that you're being sold that product. And so you use a credit card to buy a pair of pajamas, and then pajamas are constantly sold to you on Facebook. Where we make our calls from, everything we do on the day, our whole patterns, living patterns, are being tracked. Now, you say, I don't care if the government knows, but the fact is, read some of these books. There's a wonderful book called A Train in Winter. It's a really wonderful book. I wish I could give you the title. I think I have the book right here. The author. It's Caroline Moorhead, A Train in Winter, and it's about women who were in the French Resistance. And, they would be caught immediately, anybody who's trying to be in any sort of resistance movement is going to be captured immediately with this sort of spying.
So that functions as a deterrent. So even if you say, what I'm doing today is perfectly fine and no one could have any problem with it, that's fine, but it acts as a deterrent. So if something were to come along tomorrow that you felt strongly enough about, then you care about it. So in fact, by kind of knowing it's there, I'm just taking this little teeny example, and then and kind of saying, it doesn't really affect me because I'm feel good with everything I'm doing. That presumes that everything is static, nothing changes. You couldn't need it tomorrow, and at the same time, it acts as a deterrent tomorrow. There's a sense of wanting to kind of keep your head down.
Yeah,
and also
yes.
There's a sense that we're living within a political constant, and nothing could change. So
yes.
That, maybe I haven't changed and I'm still acting in integrity with what I feel are democratic rights as I know them to have been over the course of the years of my lifetime. But those definitions could theoretically, at some time in the future, we hope they don't. We hope they expand, but they could change. So,
all
of that is kind of inherent in that. I was with there were two recent instances. One, I was walking in the subway with somebody, and they objected to, I can't remember what it was. I guess the door or something about, the exit door was stuck or, hard to push or something was wrong. I can't even remember what it was, but it was just kind of a grungy kind of thing in the subway. And this friend said, how can this even be legal? And I thought, this has nothing to do with legality. This is just the condition of the subway because of the funding pattern of the city or whatever. But, it was like in his mind, this should be outlawed. In another case, somebody was going to court over this or that, and they thought they would find justice there. And, of course, what one finds is an interpretation of the laws of the system. That, you know, may be consonant with justice, or depending on how those laws change, they may not be. And so, but, you know, the assumption, so we're kind of, you know, we think all of this is unchanged as stuff is changing.
I hate to play into the right wing's sort of paranoia, mm-hmm. and you know, arming themselves and thinking that they have to mount a resistance now, and that, mm-hmm. that's really ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, the principles of democracy require that we protect privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going on. But mm-hmm. we also have the I think even more serious problem, and it's not mentioned in Citizen Four, but it's an implication that should be brought out, and that is that all the spying that NASA's doing now, the corporations are also doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means when I buy a pair of pajamas and it's on.
Right.
And corporate power is really out of control in this country now, and it's really, the corporations are far more powerful at this point than the government.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the way it should be, because it isn't because business is somehow wrong. Now, you know, we need business. Berkeley, where I live, is full of wonderful local businesses, and I'm very grateful for them. But corporate power isn't accessible to democracy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care, you know, and they say, oh, well, we give the people what they want. Well, you know, many years ago, Dwight McDonald, who was a prominent critic, said, you know, and he was responding to, I think, the head of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Sam Goldwyn, somebody like that. He said, you know, regarding movies, he said, I quoted the White Rabbit from Alice in Wonderland. I like what I get is not the same thing as I get what I like. You know, see, so we get, you know, so you may like this candy bar that advertises itself as a health bar and is supposed to help your energy, and it's full of sugar and all kinds of things you shouldn't be having, but you know. So you like it, you know, but you know what you'd perhaps really like is something that really is healthy and natural and not filled with so much sugar, but it's very, very hard to find such a thing. So, but it's not only in the range of consumer products that we have to worry about corporations, and I think I'm probably not saying anything new to most of your listeners right now, but
right.
We've got the Koch brothers and. You know, we've got this—the fact that the corporations are making money hand over fist. Not all the corporations, but the major ones are making money hand over fist. Gives them inordinate power in a democracy to buy elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these differentials in power are, you know, are really serious considering democracy. But let's get back to the whole question of the Earth. And our survival on the Earth. And there's a way in which, but let's talk about the corporations in that regard. The higher you get on the social ladder and the more money you have, the more you are able to divide yourself from earthly existence. And it becomes really surreal at the top. You know, let's talk about the Wall Street traders, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even at the very top, but they are doing the bidding of those at the very top, and they're just looking at a computer screen,
right?
And numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these numbers, they may make a trade. They may shift, you know, $8 million from one account to another, and it's just with a few clicks of a computer.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, what they're doing is impoverishing, perhaps, a whole city or a whole village.
Right.
You know, because of this shift in money from one place to another. To them, it's just an abstraction. But right. in real people's lives, it means that their children will starve.
Mm-hmm.
So we're more and more living in a world in which the people who, all the way down from the very top to professional people, are not looking at the consequences of what they're doing and the decisions they're making.
Mm-hmm.
And so forget empathy. Empathy is erased, you know, not only in masculinity, but the culture has encoded masculinity mm-hmm. in the way that things are done and in its technology.
Mm-hmm.
Masculinity being a separation from real bodily human responses to whatever is occurring around you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it also seems like our definition of life itself, you know, it's like the material substances that we take from the earth have value, but this is, you know, when we say, you know, things should be sustainable, we're talking about ecological patterns and cycles of interdependence on the earth
mm-hmm.
and amongst people. But the thing that gets left out of that, you can also have, if you try to explain that to people, it will often sound, unless you really go into it in tremendous close-up, rich detail, such as many of us are disconnected from, you know, the most prevalent analogy would be an assembly line, you know, or something mechanical. So it's
mm-hmm.
almost like the living essence of things and the fact that what we are doing are affecting, you know, beings, people, animals, species we might care about or for whom we might feel empathy, but they also seem very disrespectful toward life itself, as
yes.
if somehow life isn't part of what we're, you know, what's going on with this.
Yeah, it's the, you know, what happens in this process is that in the minds of those who are, you know, born to privilege or in a privileged position, or in the mind of the system, because the system itself has a sort of operational mind, is that everyone who is not in that position of power and all the creatures of the earth don't have souls, don't have a spirit, you know. In the meantime, they're busily erasing their own spirits, the privilege. But so if you de-spirit nature, you disenchant nature, you look at, you know, well, there's no intelligence in animals, no intelligence in plants, and, you know, and plants are, by the way, incredibly intelligent. I just learned this year. They communicate with each other, and they will space themselves in the ground, deciding which seedlings grow up by you know, according to communication, so that they're not crowding each other such that they can't survive. Isn't that amazing? There's
mm-hmm.
all kinds of things that go, and this is not somebody who's you know, mind reading plants or anything. this is from a botanist who are studying plants.
Mm.
So this is the latest botanical observations through modern science. So, but the view of modern science until very recently has been that, you know, it would be impossible for a plant to communicate. There's no intelligence in a plant. There's no, you know, there's a guy, I can't remember his name, Jeremy something. He has studied slime molds. Slime molds moving through labyrinths have shown that they're capable as an aggregate of abstract thought. You know, intelligence is very kindred. We don't think of intelligence as spiritual, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we tend to, you know, take it's part of this separation, this abstraction, when the spirit comes through monotheism to be only, you know, just believing in this one single God. You know, I tell people now if they ask what my religion is, you know, on some form or something, I say animist.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
You know, there's a God in everything.
Yes, I've always been that way since childhood.
Well, we all are since childhood.
Yeah,
I just wrote an essay about that, and that we're all, that's the, you know, look at children's books. In children's books, you know, children, look at Winnie the Pooh, you know. The animals talk, the trees communicate, and if you have small children, or you remember, I remember my own experience of talking to trees, of feeling that the tree was communicating to me. Not, you know, I hear voices as in some kind of form of schizophrenia, but you can feel the tree telling you something in your body. You can sense it, and I can still feel those things. But people are taught out of them. They're bullied out of it, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're made fun of if you continue to believe that past a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
And the children's books in which the world is animated are not imposed on children. That's the way children see, and the books are reflecting the way children actually see the world. So it's our direct experience of the world, and then we get taught out of it, and it's all part of this separation. I mean, if you separate a young man at the age of how old does a guy have to be, 18 to recruit, if you separate him from his physical body, then he doesn't feel the same fear about loss of life. He feels that there's this spirit that will, you know, the spirit is better, and the spirit will somehow survive death. It's a sort of little lie that our culture tells us. And it's not that
right.
I don't think that there's not any afterlife, but there's no way that we, as we are so constituted at this moment, can survive death, because we are so implicate with our existence on the earth. Something of us may survive, but it's not going to be ourselves in the way we know ourselves, you know. This separation, though, allows people to not to face their own mortality, for one thing.
Yes. Yes, that's very true. You know, I saw something on, it was an ad for something on public television, and it was a scientist of some kind, and or an academic of some kind, and the man was saying, there is nothing greater in the history of the world than the human brain. It is the most, you know, exalted thing that, you know, has ever come out of all creation.
Yeah.
You know, so there's also, you know, to me that epitomized what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, and at least he's saying that it came out of all creation, because the cells in our brains, are made of the stuff of stars. They're made of earth. They're made of trees, and so, you know, somehow we make this separation. Think of our brains as unique and the best going. It's really kind of infantile when you think about it. I hate to disparage infants that way. I love little children, but that term. You know, it's incredibly narcissistic and solipsistic to say such a thing.
But that's basically the civilization functions with that. You know, the product of the brain, or whatever I can cook up, and whatever I devise with whatever I cook up, has to be like a million times better than whatever I come out of.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever created me, whatever supports my life.
Exactly.
The brain could somehow go on by itself, you know.
Well, yeah, there's this computer philosopher, I can't remember his name, but he's actually posits that in the future we'll just be these brains. Ray Kurzweil, you know.
Yes, that's who I thought
his name. You know, we'll just be these brains connected to computers, and we won't have to have our bodies. I mean, I don't know. Has this guy ever eaten chocolate? I mean, what's, you know... You know, I suppose that he would say, "Oh well, we can create the experience of eating chocolate abstractly." I mean, God, wouldn't that be awful? To me, that's just the worst nightmare I can possibly think of.
Really? I mean, it does. It's really incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, the strange thing about it too is, I mean, he began as a musical engineer. You know, so.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The beauty of music and. which is really, you know, one of, I mean, it's one of the things that gives so much to us, and it's such an expression of, you know, the best potential of everything. And yeah,
well, you
that's
know,
what he came out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to take music as a good example of what we're talking about. You know, when anybody is just even speaking, not even, but playing an instrument, singing in a mm-hmm. room with you, or even if you're listening to a CD of someone doing that, or your mm-hmm. iTunes or something, your whole body is vibrating with that. Your whole body becomes an instrument. It isn't just your ear. Your ear is doing it. I mean, and then people, you know, that has to be operating for you to have the experience of hearing it. But your whole body is vibrating, mm-hmm. and your whole body becomes an acoustical chamber. So, you know, this way that we're all connected is, you know, it's in all our experience, but it needs to be taught
mm-hmm.
how it works, why it works. We need to understand it on every level, cognitively, emotionally. And when you don't give words, when you don't articulate what you're experiencing sensually, then you tend to invalidate it. You're isolated in that knowledge. You feel like a freak because we're very social beings. Mm-hmm. And that's our nature,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of our survival on this earth and our existence on this earth. And so, when our reality is not systematically not reflected back to us, we tend to erase it or forget it. And so it's very important to articulate these experiences, name them, and talk about the scientific studies that validate them, for instance, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually in the lack of reflection of them
yes.
that we also dissociate from them.
That's right. And that's why for so many of us, poetry and novels and paintings have been so important. Because one of the places where the knowledge that nature is intelligent and ensouled is allowed to... has been allowed to survive for many centuries in Western culture is in literature and the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we allow Walt Whitman to talk about, you know, the breath of a tree. You know, we allow Edvard Munch to paint the sky as screaming, which is apparent, you know, I hadn't known before that I just learned recently that Munch's painting the scream was done in response to Krakatoa. The Krakatoa mm-hmm. volcano was exploding, and it made the sky over Norway orange, and he painted this as the sky screaming. It's actually the sky screaming, and then there's a human being
wow.
there screaming too. And so,
you know, we're coming down to the last minute or two of the show, and we're going out on the end of this year, 2014.
Yes.
So I'd love to hear a wish, you know, for well-being. You know, what if we could have, you know, and I'll chime in too. But and we only have about a minute or so. But
well, let's make this new year. Let's mm-hmm. thank the last year for teaching us in very many ways how important it is for us to change the way we live on the earth. And let's make the next year the year that we devote to changing cooperatively among ourselves the way we cooperate with the other beings on the earth and halt climate change in its insofar as we can in its tracks.
Aho, amen. That sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great
pleasure talking with you. Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, listeners, for a wonderful year on Connect the Dots. And I'll be back with you in this coming year, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Progressive Radio Network. It's Allison Rose Levy and Susan Griffin wishing you a good and caring and productive and creative new year, and a healthy one. for yourselves and for ourselves and for the earth.